Its current state on 90.5 WKAR for Tuesday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you're here. Michigan enjoys unique authority regarding federal wetlands, but that unique authority may be revoked. We will explore that issue coming up in just a few minutes. We also have the latest data from the annual Kids Count survey, which explores the well-being of children in Michigan. Jane Zender Merrill, director of the Kids Count in Michigan survey, joins us in just a few minutes. You can always reach us via email with your feedback, input, ideas, criticism, whatever. Current state at WKAR.org. We appreciate hearing from you. At the top of our program today, last week, Ingham County commissioners voted 13-1 to demand that the city of Lansing pay the $1.1 million the county says it is owed for pension and health insurance obligations for the 34 city-employed 911 dispatchers who were transferred last year to the new Ingham County Dispatch Center. The county's deadline is January 15th. If payment's not received by then, they say they'll sue the city. Here to offer the city's perspective on this dispute, Chad Gamble, Chief Operating Officer and Director of Public Service for the City of Lansing. Welcome back, Chad.
Mark, it's great to be here.
Can you help us make sense of what's going on here? And maybe a little history is in order. What was the motivation, the original motivation, to move the city's 911 dispatchers into the county's, into this new 911 center?
Well, the original genesis of this idea came when back almost a decade ago, really, we looked at the situation and said, well, East Lansing has a 911 dispatch, City of Lansing has a 911 dispatch, Ingham County has a 911 dispatch. And gee, that seems to be an awful lot of redundancy and problems just generally associated with that. So there began a fairly long journey about someone saying, gee, wouldn't it be fantastic if we were able to consolidate and synthesize all these 911 dispatches to a singular countywide dispatch center.
Kind of an early iteration of regionalism there.
Absolutely.
One of the first.
Absolutely. And this began our journey of trying to figure out how we go about doing that.
And update the current situation here for you. Apparently the county feels it's entitled to over $1 million to cover the health and pension obligations of these city employees. Tell us a little bit more about that particular dispute.
Right. We were talking before, and anytime someone says, gee, we think we should consolidate, it's not an easy task. I think when Mark D'Antonio said at the beginning of the year, gee, I think we should win the Rose Bowl, it's a simple statement. But, there began a journey and a lot of hard work went into that, and I think we're going to win. But this is not dissimilar to that. We had a mission and a goal to be able to do something regionally. And when it gets down to the nuts and bolts about OPEB liabilities, about the transfer of these assets that we have been accumulating for these then city employees, we were putting away money for their retirement. And then to find out actually how much money we were putting away for each singular employee over the past 20 years, it takes a lot of getting into the books of exactly calculating what that was. And I don't want to get too detailed, but there's actuarial adjustments, actuarial assumptions that were made, and then there was an adjustment made that looks at the current market, the current way that we are looking at the retirement fund, the return on our investments, the economy, those types of variables. And just before the transfer, that was reset, and it actually brought down the number because of the economy and everything else. You have to remember that this is a very large investment fund, and it performs as does the economy. So there are also a lot of assumptions associated with that. And it was just, I think, a dispute of exactly what that calculation is and how we're able to resolve it.
Are county and city personnel at least beginning to collaborate on what the correct number is? Or has that kind of collaboration been going on? Or is that the process that's just starting right now?
We've been working on this for years. Trying to understand, what that number is, work with the retirement board, that from the city's perspective is the board that actually makes the final decision.
But you've got your people in the city working on it, and the county's got their people working on it on the same calculation?
We've been working on this for a number of years. What there was an original calculation that we were operating under back in 2009, I believe. And then, periodically, as these adjustments are made and looking at the funds and making targets of how much money we should invest, that number was recalculated, as it normally is. And based on that recalculation, those two numbers were different. And thus, that's the crux of the issue of, you know, whose number is right. And we've been meeting very collaboratively with the county. And I think, you know, some people perhaps get impatient with a very difficult process. And I have all the confidence in the world. And Tim Dolhaney, the county controller, that he and I and the rest of our respective teams can find a way for this to win, because we've got a lot more work to do out there as far as regionalism, as far as working together.
And
some of these things, they're hard. And you know, if everything was easy, you know, we would all be in a beach somewhere just making money. But this is a hard thing, and this is what, you know, our citizens, the county people who in the same, we're representing the same people. We owe it to them to work really hard to do something which is right. And when it gets tough, we can't abandon ship. We can't do something that we don't think is prudent for those people. We need to work hard.
What do you make, though, of the county's setting of this deadline in January, which implies the opportunity to file a lawsuit or the willingness to file a lawsuit?
Well, I think, like I said, some people get a little impatient, and they don't understand the big picture. Is working to get a regional approach to this, amongst many things, is not easy. It's hard, and some things weren't originally anticipated. But that doesn't mean we should just abandon ship. You know, we are very symbiotic entities. We make up a lot of the county. The county makes up a lot of the city of Lansing. You know, we are they, and they are we, and we owe it to work together. And not stop until we're able to solve this issue, because this is going to be the cookie cutter for many other agreements, many other opportunities that we have to work together to streamline our services, to save money for county residents and city residents.
But does this possibility of a lawsuit help or hurt?
Well, certainly, you know, the commissioners who voted, we don't like them to vote to sue the city. And I think that's just a representative of perhaps their impatience and being a little bit step back from that. From our point of view, it doesn't hurt, because I know that Tim and I and our teams are going to be able to get it done. There's no question in my mind that their hard work and our hard work are going to pay off, and we're going to come to an agreement that is mutually acceptable.
And it really boils down to the figure. Is there one number? I mean, or there's a series of numbers that you have to come to agreement on?
There is a couple of different numbers that we have to come to agreement on. And there was a transfer agreement that kind of, you know, all kind of tried to bookend this, and you know that, you know, no agreement anticipates every single solitary variable that can come into play. And because this took a little bit longer than was anticipated, there was a couple things that became part of that we weren't able to look at in our crystal ball when this was originally inked. So, and that's really it, is just trying to get to a win, is trying to get to make the two systems whole, the monies that will be transferred to the county and the system from which the monies are being transferred. So we want to make sure that those two systems are whole, that it is a fair and equitable transfer, that the board that oversees the retirement system can look at it and say, yes, this is a good thing for both parties.
We're talking with Chad Gamble, who's the City of Lansing's Chief Operating Officer and Director of Public Service. In addition to pension obligations, retiree health insurance is another part of the discussion. Tell us about that.
That number is actually being calculated. It was put back on a back burner, agreeable to try and bring this pension calculation to an end. And we're going to be meeting with the county just before the 15th of January and trying to give them an estimate of that. And that falls into the same calculation where we're going back 20 years in some instances and trying to find out what contributions were made on behalf of the city, what contributions were made by the employee, and then try to get down to an exact number.
How do you expect this to play out, Chad? Will it come down to a mediator?
I don't think so. I think that we will be able to work this out. There may be perhaps a third party that might be brought in. You know, they have their number and we have our number. And maybe we bring in, you know, someone else who says, okay, well, let's see what the number is, kind of a mutually agreed to actuarial person.
Where would that person come from?
You know, there's lots of people a whole lot smarter than I am out there who calculate all this stuff. We hired actuarial adjusters. That's where the two numbers came from. So if we're able to say, hey, you know, there's another actuarial out there somewhere that's an expert that can come in and we mutually agree to whatever they calculate as the number, that's the number. That could be a way that we will go. But, you know, this is a tough nut to crack. But I think that we're able to do it, and with Tim's leadership at the county and our team, we're able to do something that I think, again, is going to be acceptable to both parties.
I mean, the county seems to have clearly demonstrated their impatience, though. 13-1 vote. I guess my question is, can you come up with these important figures? Can you come to an agreement on these important figures by the time that the county would like?
Yeah, I think if we show a progress, as we have been working over the past year, I think they will understand that our mutual goal is to solve this and make sure that transfer is fair and equitable. You know, we have other employees that are in that fund that's, you know, kind of their money as well. So when you transfer that money out, you want to make sure you get it right. And that's what we're trying to do, is to make sure that from both sides we get it right.
You seem to be characterizing this as more of a friendly disagreement than a battle.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, any time you have regional issues, you know, we're not adversarial to the county. We're going to be working a lot together. And you know, they're very symbiotic. I said before that we have a lot of the same people who live in the county live in the city. And we cannot sit and let some of these things get in the way of progress. There will be lots of things, lots of hurdles that come up, both in life and in our professional careers, that will try to stop good progress. And I understand that perhaps some county commissioners are getting a little impatient. Heck, we're impatient. We would like this thing to be over as well. But, you know, these things are very difficult issues, and I think they just want to see this thing come to an end, as do we. And I think very soon after the new year, I think they're going to get perhaps hopefully a late Christmas present, and we'll get this thing all wrapped up and celebrate.
Pension and insurance obligations aside, update us on the 911 center operation. It had its share of challenges early on.
Absolutely. Whenever you transfer those kind of three entities into one, you know, they have different computing systems, they have different standard operating procedures, and I think they went through a growing pains, if you will, in trying to make sure that their service to the county is the best that it possibly can be. And I think that's where it is at, because, you know, that is literally the lifeline for many people.
I know there was confusion over what street in, you know, similarly named, identically named streets in different jurisdictions led to some confusion.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And those potentially a very serious problem.
It is.
Has that been resolved?
Yes. There's been a protocol engaged, a committee by, you know, the fire chiefs and police chiefs, that they get together and look at problems that have come up, you know, as they happen, to make sure that they're not missing anything, that they're not leaving any stone unturned. So that is an important oversight committee that will filter information that comes from each of the communities that are serviced by the county 911 system, to make sure that those issues are known throughout the 911 community and are also communicated to the managers and 911 operators, so they understand the problem, they're educated, and they learn from yesterday so their tomorrows are much better.
Always a good conversation with Chad Gamble, Director of Public Service for the City of Lansing and the city's Chief Operating Officer. Chad, thanks.
Have a blessed Christmas.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Now, a story involving Michigan's many wetlands. Michigan is one of only two states that have the authority to regulate federal wetlands within their borders. However, the Environmental Protection Agency may revoke that power. Last week, the EPA held a hearing to determine if Michigan's environmental standards for wetland management meet federal benchmarks. Wetland management may not seem to have a high legal significance, but according to environmental attorney Solis Michelonis, wetlands management is often at the heart of legal disputes. Michelonis is a senior attorney at Plunkett Cooney. He also writes an environmental law column for Crane's Detroit Business. Solis Michelonis, welcome back to Current State.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Before we delve into this latest legal battle over wetlands, help us understand why there are regularly so many legal battles over wetlands.
The reason there are a lot of legal battles over wetlands is a couple. The main reason is there's development pressures. People who own land want to develop their lands, and oftentimes those lands have wetlands on them. And what they would like to do is fill them and build on them. But federal and state law prevent that from occurring. And you have to get a permit in order to get dredge and fill permits and things like that to actually do what you want to do on your property. And that is causes a conflict between the federal and state government and those developers generally.
And give us a good working definition of a wetland.
Well, a wetland is basically a swamp. It's an area that is inundated with water at least part time of the year. Basically, if you see an area with cattails, things like that, and a lot of times it's not even that easy to identify a wetland. There are things called wooded wetlands and other types of wetlands too. So it's a very technical explanation, but it generally has a hydrogeological connection with surface body water.
And Michigan is one of only two states in the nation that has regulatory control over its wetlands. How did that unfold? Why does Michigan have control over its wetlands?
Well, under the wetlands are regulated under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, and there's a provision in the Clean Water Act, as there are in other environmental statutes, that allows states to regulate in lieu of the federal government so long as their programs are at least as stringent as the federal program. The federal program basically sets a floor below which a state cannot go. So basically the state comes in and says, I want to regulate these wetlands, here's our program. EPA takes a look at the program, says, yes, these programs are at least as stringent as ours, and we have concurrent authority to regulate those wetlands. So it's not just the state of Michigan has the authority to regulate wetlands, so does the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers as well. So it's concurrent authority.
So in the past, you're saying Michigan has met or exceeded the federal standards for regulating wetlands?
Yes, because EPA made that determination when Michigan decided they wanted to regulate their wetlands. So there was an initial determination that EPA had to make and review the program, the statutes, the regulations, and determine that Michigan was in compliance.
And indeed now that is being challenged by the EPA. Last week the EPA held a hearing on whether they should revoke that authority under the Clean Water Act. What are the EPA's concerns here?
Well, the process begins by somebody, an environmental group in this instance, saying that the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, the Michigan regulations, and the statutes by the Michigan legislature have changed the program to a certain extent that it no longer is consistent with the federal program. And so what EPA had done is they did a study, and this has been going on for at least a decade, in reviewing Michigan's program. They came back to Michigan and says, and told them that your program is not consistent. The legislature went back and tried to redraft Part 303, is the Michigan environmental statute that deals with wetlands, and tried to revamp the program and try to make it consistent. And this hearing was basically saying, okay, and there's still challenges even after the changes, saying, okay, we're going to have a hearing, we're going to have public comment period, and we'll decide at that point in time whether or not you are in fact consistent. And some of the changes that the state of Michigan has made over the years includes putting deadlines on DEQ to make determinations on wetland permits. They don't have any sort of drop-dead dates in the federal program. They expanded some of the allowances in terms of allowing dredging and filling in existing drainage ditches. They changed the definition of contiguous wetlands to actually make it more restrictive. Those are the types of things that were being criticized by these environmental groups, and that's what EPA is looking at.
And the Michigan legislature seems to have been aware for some time that the EPA would challenge the state's authority on wetland regulation. The state made an amendment to try and comply with the federal regs, but those changes have a caveat. What is that caveat?
Well, the caveat is that the Michigan legislature sort of put a poison pill in their latest draft, and it basically states this, that if EPA revokes the authorization for DEQ and the state of Michigan to regulate wetlands in the state of Michigan, the entire wetland program will no longer exist in the state of Michigan. So basically, DEQ will step out back completely from regulating any wetlands. Now, this is important not only because, you know, they'll step back, they won't be regulating a lot of these wetlands, but there's a lot of state-regulated wetlands that aren't federally regulated wetlands.
Right.
And if the state-regulated wetlands aren't regulated anymore, then it's open game on those. And that's sort of the poison pill that the legislature put in there, telling EPA basically no one will be looking at those other wetlands that you are not regulating anymore.
Are there more federal wetlands or state wetlands in Michigan?
I couldn't tell you. I don't know. I would guess, considering the size of our shorelines and the lengths of our rivers and streams, there's probably a lot more federally regulated wetlands.
Okay. So then what happens if Michigan's authority is revoked?
Then the state of Michigan, all the permits and all the things that you would need to get in order to get a dredge or fill permit. For example, you have a piece of property and you want to run a driveway up to your property, but to do it, you have to go over a wetland to get that permit. You would have to now go to the federal government instead of the state of Michigan.
Hmm. This is not the first time that Michigan has faced losing control of its wetlands. Review for us what happened during the Granholm administration, please.
Well, during the Granholm administration is when the first challenge to Michigan's wetland laws was first in place. And at that point in time, Governor Granholm was trying to determine how she was going to address that. And she had an option. I mean, one of her options was to basically let it go. And there wasn't a lot of money being allocated to DEQ, and they had to make some budget decisions on what to do, and there was a serious consideration back in the Granholm administration to basically say, okay, fine, we're not going to regulate wetlands anymore. We'll use our scarce resources and focus on other things, air, water, other types of issues. But then the state backed off of that.
And tell us, Solis, where and how is this issue being argued, being debated right now?
Well, right now, they as you mentioned in the lead-in, there was a public hearing last week in Lansing. The public comment period remains open. So if anyone has a comment, any citizen, any group has a comment, you can still submit those comments to EPA directly until December 18th. So written comments are available. You go on to online. There's a webpage, www.regulations.gov, and you can make your comments at that point in time. You can also email them. There's also an email, web ow-docket@epa.gov. You can also place your comments there. And there are public comments being made right now. What happens is that it develops a public record. Then EPA will sit down and look at all the comments it received at the public comment period, during the public comment period, and then make a decision whether or not to revoke DEQ's authority to regulate wetlands in Michigan.
I want to ask you one more question here that appears to be relevant. A separate case reviewed by the Supreme Court could also impact wetlands in Michigan. This is Koontz v. St. Johns River Water Management District. Koontz v. St. Johns River Water Management District. Could you explain what's happening there? What's the dispute?
You know what? You caught me at a bad time. I know the case, and I'm just drawing a blank on it.
Okay.
I apologize. But.
Okay. Well, that apparently plays some kind of role in here. It's working parallel, as I understand, to this other discussion. Will wetlands continue to be a hot topic in the legal realm?
Yes, it will. EPA right now is trying to determine what regulations apply to what wetlands. There was a U.S. Supreme Court decision that came down a few years ago, actually involved a Michigan case called Rapanos, in which the Supreme Court severely restricted what wetlands are federally regulated wetlands pursuant to the Clean Water Act. And EPA has, ever since that decision came down, trying to define what are regulated wetlands and what are not. And so they've been doing studies and preparing regulations, and that is getting a very close look at by everyone. There's a draft document came out earlier this summer that everybody looked at, and based on what I've read about it, people think that it will greatly expand federal jurisdiction over a lot of wetlands. Hmm. And basically the focus is there a hydrogeological connection between the particular wetland and a regulated water, which is the test under Rapanos, and it's all very scientific and basically trying to justify EPA's regulation over certain wetlands.
Solas Michelonis is a senior attorney at Plunkett Cooney. He has practiced environmental law for over 25 years, and you can find more of his work on the intersection of law and the environment on his blog, Cranes Detroit. Mr. Michelonis, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us for Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. A sharply growing percentage of Ingham County children appear to be victims of abuse and neglect. And 5 years after the Great Recession, more children in Ingham County remain eligible for food assistance than the statewide average. Those findings are among the sobering data in the latest Kids Count survey made public today by the Michigan League for Public Policy. Kids Count explores child well-being county by county across the state. They focus on four key areas: economic security, health, family and community, and education. Fortunately, the new survey also discovers some improvements for the state's most vulnerable. Joining Current State to explore the latest trends is Kids Count Director James Ender Merrill. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Let's review this striking increase statewide of abuse and neglect. What numbers can you share with us?
Well, children who live in families investigated for abuse and neglect is up by 41%. That's a pretty substantial...
From when to when?
From 2005 to 2012. Part of this might be explained by the fact that the state now has a centralized intake, so people can call an 800 number to report abuse and neglect. This is a big change from the way it used to be, where county by county made their own decisions about which cases to investigate.
So we may be marginally better, at least, at identifying these cases. Is that it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. I would say so.
But still, 41%, that is a dramatic increase.
That's right. I mean, we're talking about over 200,000 children.
Yes.
Living in a family where there was an investigation conducted. And what the research shows is that even if there's no confirmation of the abuse or neglect, these children are likely to still be at risk, some very high risk, in fact, even though we couldn't confirm whether the abuse or neglect occurred. Mm-hmm. The fact that they just came to the attention of the department, mm-hmm. that the case fit the definition of what we consider abuse or neglect, is definitely a cause for concern.
Some number of them were confirmed.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And this is the highest number in over 20 years.
Yes.
I understand.
Absolutely.
Okay. And Ingham County, to what extent is Ingham County a part of that trend?
Well, Ingham County actually reflects what's happening in the state as a whole. Ingham County is even more dramatic in terms of what happened because it's doubled, essentially, between 2005 and 2012. Mm. And it is the rate in Ingham County at 28 of every 1,000 children is double the state average rate. Mm. So that's pretty dramatic. You also see in Ingham County relatively high rates of children going into foster care, out-of-home care. And the state as a whole has seen a reduction in that.
What do you think accounts for this dramatic increase in abuse and neglect?
Most of it has to do with neglect. 80% of confirmed abuse neglect has to do with neglect, which means essentially that a family doesn't have the resources to meet the basic needs of their kids, which is not surprising when you look at the child poverty numbers in this state and you look at the long-term impact of a economy that's took a nosedive starting in 2000 and never really came back up. I mean, we have a sizable proportion of people who have been out of the job market. Our unemployment rate is still at 9%, and we've been leading the nation in unemployment. And all this takes a toll on families. Families are struggling. We've also cut prevention programs in this state that provide supports for families so that they don't end up coming to the attention of the child welfare authorities.
We're talking with Jane Zender Merrill of the Michigan League for Public Policy about the latest kids count data, which was officially released here today. The other area that dramatically worsened this time around, and you alluded to it earlier, economic security. Ingham County has a greater percentage of young children eligible for food assistance than the county statewide average. How many here in Ingham County, and how many statewide?
It's 7,600 in the county, and it's about 250,000 statewide.
And again, this is all of a piece here.
Right.
What do you think accounts for the rise specifically of that number?
Well, these are young their parents are probably young, trying to get into the job market, and we know the job market is very tight right now. And even if they get a job, the chances of that job paying above the minimum wage are slim.
Mm-hmm. Is economic security your most closely watched measurement?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It has such a huge impact on all the other indicators of child well-being. We know that kids that grow up in poverty, their health outcomes are compromised, their educational outcomes, it's across the board. So when we see 500,000 kids in this state who are growing up in families with income below the poverty level, that should be a flashing red light at the legislature about what are the consequences of this and what can we do. And what we've been doing, we're cutting programs that help people survive economic downturns.
The thick of the Great Recession was exactly 5 years ago. Are any of these trends, can you argue that any of these trends are still fallout from that, or are the newer forces that you just alluded to, cuts from the state, are they more relevant?
I think it's, well, combination, I think confluence. Yes,
okay.
A confluence of the two. When you look at last year compared to this year, the fall off, we've seen a slight drop in the percentage of young children who are eligible for the SNAP benefit. And we've seen an uptick in child poverty. So instead of leveling out or going down, we are still seeing pretty dramatic impact of the recession.
You're saying fewer kids eligible need on the rise at the same time.
Right, and you know, for example, we're instituting now asset limits on SNAP benefits. So if you're if you lost your job and your family has some assets, we're going to make you spend down all those assets before we're going to give you any assistance with food.
Another striking finding that this jumped out at me anyway is how concentrated geographically some of these trends are. Place appears to be critical. For example, one Michigan county, according to your survey, ranked absolutely last in more than half of the 15 child wellness indicators that you measure. That's one county, Lake County, Keweenaw Peninsula. Can you explain that?
Well, the Lake County has been persistently poor over many decades, and it's been an issue.
A long, hard road back.
Yeah, it's a long, hard road. And we find, in fact, people, when they think about child poverty, they think about poverty in the urban areas. But actually, poverty is much higher in our rural areas in northern Michigan, much more use of our public programs that help families get through these downturns. And our counties in the northeastern part of the state have been particularly hard hit.
Very interesting. Conversely, I mean, Livingston County ranked number one in five categories. So you see this confluence of really dire straits in particular areas, and you see the rewards kind of accruing in the same. Can county governments learn from each other? Is there any kind of best practices lesson here for county government?
Well, counties can institute programming, but counties and communities are under a lot of stress now as well, with the lack of revenue sharing from the state.
Ultimately, they're still reliant on tax revenue.
Exactly.
Federal government revenue.
And when people say, well, you know, there's lots communities can do, but it's nowhere near the scope of the need that is prevalent in our communities. And in Michigan, we have relatively high levels of children, large percentage of children in areas of concentrated poverty, meaning not only is their family living on income below the poverty level, but in their community, there are lots of people living below the poverty level. There's few community resources. So to try to push this down to the community level, especially in a state like Michigan, where we're double the percentage of the national average in terms of children living in concentrated poverty, really doesn't solve the problem.
I want to cover two important areas before we wrap up. Number one is that there were some improvements in the data as well.
Yes.
Let's talk about those. And after that, let's definitely talk about what you would recommend in terms of policy.
Sure.
Where are we improving?
You want the good news?
Yes.
Okay, that's fair enough. The most dramatic improvement has been the 33% decline in children going in and out of home care. That means moving in the foster care system. And we know that a lot of research is showing what a detrimental effect that has on kids. So if there's any way to avoid removing kids from their families, we need to be doing that. So the state is making an effort to move kids out of the foster care system and to stop the flow of kids into the system. So that's good. The second most dramatic improvement is in the percentage of children at the fourth grade level who are able to demonstrate their reading skills to a proficient level. So we still have roughly 34,000 kids statewide who are not able to perform at proficient levels, which is definitely a concern. But what we do see is a pretty dramatic improvement between 2008 and 2012.
And what particular policy measures are really on your short list here as far as changing this situation?
Short list in terms of the economic issues, we think it's really important that we restore the state earned income tax credit. That was on the books at 20%. It's been reduced to 6%. It rewards working families, puts money in the local economy. These are families at very low income. It helps families with children. That's really its target, and that's something with the increased revenue at the state we can afford. We should also be raising the eligibility and adjusting the scale of our child care subsidy. Hasn't been adjusted for inflation in over two decades. So this really limits the capacity of working families. Child care is a huge expense. It uses almost half of a minimum wage. So if you can't get that child care subsidy, it really does have an impact.
Are legislators in general receptive to your survey?
I think that they are listening, perhaps, but the decisions that they're making about their budget priorities do not reflect their concerns, I would have to say.
Are you at all optimistic about the policy recommendations you're making?
I'm sure hoping now that we see some revenue coming into the state and that the governor has child poverty on his dashboard as something he would like to see improved. We hope that there'll be some policies and budget priorities put forward to address these issues.
Very good. We want to thank you for joining us here today. Jane Zender Merrill is the director of the Kids Count in Michigan survey. She's an executive with the Michigan League for Public Policy. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Mark.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. The role of the academic journal in scientific research is changing rapidly. A New York Times article earlier this year looked at the problem of pseudo-academic journals, which had names similar to well-established ones and which charged hefty fees for publication. More recently, Randy Shekman, a Nobel Prize-winning U.S. biologist, said his lab would no longer send papers to several academic journals that some consider top-tier. But Shekman contends their policies encourage scientists to pursue trendy research rather than more significant, less sexy projects. Joining us now to talk about the changing world of academic journals, Dr. Jim Pavarnik. He's MSU's Research Integrity Officer. He's also a professor in the departments of kinesiology and epidemiology. Dr. Pavarnik, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, name a few of the more popular journals that our listeners might be familiar with.
Well, certainly Science, Nature, that's the UK's version of Science, New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, used to be called the Journal of the American Medical Association. Those are some of the top ones that everybody hears about.
And review for us what function these journals actually provide for serious researchers.
Well, they are known as the top journals for a number of reasons. They're cited very frequently, meaning people will tend to read their articles and then use them as references in their own. They service a wide range of readers, so it's not a, let's say, an obstetrics audience or a pediatric audience. It's a medical audience or a general science audience. So your average scientist or your average person interested in medical science would read these before they might read their own little subspecialty journals.
Mm. So now entering into this world of academic publishing, are some journals that have names very similar to established publications? Tell us about those.
Right. There are thousands now of, in the last 10 or 15 years, and the U.S. has a couple thousand itself, thousands of these open access online type journals. And the open access means I don't have to have a subscription. I don't have to go to the library, or I don't have to have my own subscription to actually read the science. So it's very attractive to the reader. On the other hand, to the person publishing in those journals, it's very expensive. The page charges that virtually all journals have are extraordinary in these particular journals. That's how they survive.
And so talk to us about some of the problems associated with those open access sources.
Well, they're very attractive. They're very sexy to the scientist who might be frustrated not being able to get his or her work in the top-tier journals. These open access journals offer sort of a quick fix in some cases, that you can get things published quickly and you can get it published, period. And those are two good things.
So do we have two camps developing here, those that defend, you got a conservative liberal kind of divide emerging here?
It's not quite that simple, but you're close. You're close. There was a study I don't know if it was a study, several months ago, where somebody wrote up a bogus research article and sent it to a number of these open access journals just to see if they'd publish it. He made up the names. He did all sorts of stuff. There was nothing to it.
And they got in?
More than half got in.
Word.
And a lot of these didn't even have the peer review system. The downside to that is he did not send it to the more traditional journals, so we don't have the answer as to whether they would have accepted it also. So that set off a big scientific debate on the value of that study, plus the whole issue that we're talking about this morning.
Recently, the winner of this year's Nobel Prize announced that his lab would no longer send papers to the journals Nature, cell and science. I alluded to Randy Scheckman earlier. Some people consider those top-tier publications.
Right, those are.
And he says, Randy Scheckman says, that basically the journals focus on topics that are trendy and, quote, sexy, rather than having serious scientific import. What do you make of Scheckman's claim?
Well, certainly when you're the Nobel Prize winner, people tend to listen.
Yeah.
I think a skeptic might say that on more than one occasion, even somebody as great as this individual might have gotten a rejection from one of these journals and possibly held a bit of a grudge. I've read some of the give and take by various scientists on this about his opinion, and they agree that that's what it is an opinion. And the fact that he won the Nobel Prize, he was picked by an elite group of people, and he's calling these elite journals. So there is the opposing view to what he's saying.
He has his own online journal as well.
Right.
Does his own journal live up to the standards that he defends?
Well, that's to be decided. I think it's fairly new. I think certainly he's well respected, and people tend to give, in their studies on this, give more credit to an article. If you and I turned in an article on a particular topic, the same topic that this gentleman would turn the article in, he would more likely get published just because of his name, even if the science is exactly the same. So there's that sort of an effect going on too. So it's very complicated.
What a curious landscape this
is.
Some of this is follow the money, the conflict between the traditional business model of journals that actually have to sell product, mm-hmm. and an emerging movement that encourages this open access that you're talking about. Can you help us understand that a little bit better?
Right. A lot of the traditional journals, the ones that you would get in the mail or you would go to the library to read, that they have many, many advertisements in them. A lot of them are drug companies or whatever equipment, medical equipment, and these folks pay a lot of money to be in the journal because a lot of people read them. So that's where they get most of their revenue, some revenue from their organizations as well. As opposed to the open access, they really don't have this, so they charge exorbitant amounts to the people, not only to people that are published, but there are some of these journals who charge you money just to submit. So there's not even a guarantee that you'll be published, but you have to pay on the front end. So it is totally a different business model.
Now, you're involved in the departments of kinesiology here at MSU.
Correct.
Epidemiology. What journals do you read? What journals do your colleagues read?
Well, certainly in kinesiology, the primary one we read is called Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise. It's the top exercise science journal out there. In epidemiology, it would be likely the American Journal of Epidemiology.
Are those old? Those are the old
Correct.
School type of approaches?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. There are some newer ones that are out there that some of my colleagues have published in. I have an article in one, an obstetrics journal, with some colleagues. But I haven't gotten into that mix too much.
Well, can you say that the open source publications have their place, but that maybe the standards need to be just marginally stricter? Is there a case for that?
I think there is a case, and I think I think it's a bad rap to call all open source journals substandard, you will. A lot of them have very high standards. A lot of them don't. And what's a mother to do? How do you know unless you delve into it? And they've exploded. There are thousands and thousands of them now. So to fight your way through that, as opposed to, well, I know New England Journal of Medicine is a good one. I know this traditional one in my field is a good one. You don't have to mess with, does it have the good reputation? Now, that reputation is not perfect, but the open access one is still kind of the Wild West out there with those.
Do you anticipate new forums emerging?
Well, I think probably some blended models. I know now that the big issue, think about it, publication is the second largest capital we have in academia. The first is obviously bringing in grant money, but you have to get your science read by people. So it's very, very important to academicians to get your stuff out there. Well, if a traditional journal takes 10 months to get something out into the press, as opposed to an open access that can do it in 2 weeks on the computer, where are you going to go? So now some of the traditional ones have their online versions that can hit the streets a lot sooner. So they're sort of blending the new computer read it online versus the magazine version.
Does the larger public play a role in this, or are we really talking about specialists? Are we really talking about people in the scientific community?
Well, I think the larger public can play a role because every night on every news station there's a medical report. And the medical writers go to some sources. And where do they go? They go to
NPR frequently refers to a lot of these journals.
Sure. And those are easy. Those were traditional. That doesn't mean the new ones aren't just as good and there's not something in there. But if you're a reporter and you're looking for this, how much time are you going to spend on these other journals when you have your traditional ones? So it's difficult.
Is this the kind of dispute that all of your colleagues have a take on? Is this a highly charged enough topic in your world that everybody comes down on one side of the ledger or the other?
They come down somewhere. I think there's a lot of sides of the ledger. It goes with promotion. It goes with tenure. It goes with annual reviews and what you call a quality journal, what is not a quality journal. It's the further we go, the muddier it gets.
Is there something on the timeline coming up ahead that you feel might resolve this or clarify this dispute?
I think if the journal editors, years ago there was a group of journal editors, they called them the Vancouver group back then because they met in Vancouver, medical journal editors that standardized the way that articles should be written for particular medical journals. And that went a long way with getting everybody, you know, singing out of the same hymn book. I think if you can do that same sort of thing with the open access folks versus the more traditional folks, then we might get somewhere.
Dr. Jim Pavarnik is MSU's Research Integrity Officer. We've been talking about academic journals. Jim, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we take a look at Michigan's primary care physician shortage. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment features the R.J. Scheffel Toy Project. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for listening to Current State. We're 90.5 WKAR.